This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The Lunar New Year is on February 1st, and 3 days later, the Winter Olympics kick off in Beijing. And with China maintaining strict COVID protocols, ticket sales have been halted, and the mood in the capital there is tense. Asher Gillespie has lived in Beijing for many years, and he owns a pizzeria there. Its English name is Pi Square.
Fong Pai Pizza. I grew up in Michigan, so it's a Detroit-style pizza place in Beijing.
Are you all going to eat Hawaii, or do you want to do half?
Yeah, we do half and half.
You order at the counter, and then you go sit down. I've got six tabs of different beers there.
In 2000, Gillespie went to China to study as an undergraduate for a year.
And actually, in that time, that's when they announced that Beijing had gotten the rights to the 2008 Olympics, the Summer Olympics. So that was one of the reasons that China seemed so exciting at the time. You could tell a boom was kind of coming, and I just figured there'd be a lot of job opportunities coming. In the era that I was here, so 2000 onwards, there was slowly a growing restaurant community. So you could find barbecue. Eventually, some Mexican places came into town. You could find kind of each and every type of food. And actually, that kind of went all the way through the 2008 Olympics. And you got it by just kind of having that style of food. And then kind of during and after the Olympics, people came in over the top, and then you had to actually be good at doing that food.
2008 drummers to coincide with the 2008 Olympic year.
The 2008 Games were a huge moment for China, a kind of debut on the modern world stage as not only an economic powerhouse, but a cultural force as well.
And they had that amazing opening ceremony, and we were just all kind of blown away. And then I remember getting phone calls from my parents and some friends just being like, that was incredible. So there was a real excitement for it. You know, it was the summer, it's hot, I think people were working, but it just seemed like 2 weeks of just going around, going to every venue, trying to check out this water polo, volleyball.
Officials are ready. We are ready. Let's get this gold medal match underway.
Beach volleyball. We went to some track and field. We did a baseball game. I don't know. I just felt like there was no shortage of events to go to, and people just kind of handed tickets. Oh, we went to a soccer game. It really, really was a good time.
Argentina.
You know, when it was announced that Beijing got the 2022 Winter Olympics, we were all kind of excited and planning for how to maximize opportunities to do good business and have a good time during those games. You know, this is the one. It's right in Beijing. It'll be live when we're open, right? We have a lot of local Chinese coming into the restaurant, but we also have people from all over the world in our restaurant. And so it would have been fun throwing on the games, having some friendly chit-chat over a couple beers while any event is going on, because you're just, everybody's going to root for their country to win, but it doesn't really matter at the end. It's all just a good time, and it's competition. So we would have loved it.
Now that, of course, was before wave after wave of COVID started hitting the world.
We were all wondering for these last couple months, are tickets going to be on sale? Are we going to be able to go? Or if we go, are we going to have to be in the bubble? Are we going to have to quarantine before we go in the bubble? Or are we going to have to quarantine when we go out of the bubble? So, and these things are kind of changing as, you know, even as we speak. You know, we're going to be watching from TV just like everybody else is.
Asher Gillespie at Pi Squared in Beijing. Now, the complications, the very real complications facing the Winter Olympics in Beijing go well beyond COVID. The Games have put a gigantic spotlight on China's human rights abuses, most critically, the genocide taking place against the Uyghurs. The U.S. government and some other nations are boycotting the Games in a limited way, leaving diplomats and officials at home, though their athletes are competing. I'm joined now by Louisa Thomas, a staff writer who covers sports from football to gymnastics to chess, and Peter Hessler, who's been our China correspondent for many years. Now, Peter, I want to start off with you. Normally, you would be in Beijing for these Olympics, but you're not. How come?
Well, I taught in China for 2 years, 2019 until last July. And then my teaching contract was not renewed. No explanation was ever given. No official explanation was given for that. But it seems obvious that it was for political reasons. And, you know, this has been a period when we've had the expulsion of many American journalists. There's very few foreign reporters living in China right now. I mean, there's very few foreigners in general. There's probably never been a period that has had so few foreign correspondents, foreign observers on the ground in China.
Certainly, it's not the first time that we've seen an authoritarian government in China or many other governments, and foreign correspondents are allowed to stay and certainly to cover something, a spectacle like an Olympic Games. Why would they clear out Beijing, much less where you were living in Chengdu?
I mean, there's a number of reasons, but I mean, really what kicked it off in a lot of ways was the Trump administration. So the Trump administration expelled Chinese journalists in early 2020. And China immediately countered by expelling most of the American journalists. Part of it was a tit for tat. And then the other element that has really played into this, of course, is the pandemic. They're following a zero tolerance strategy toward COVID, which has been broadly supported by the people and probably, you know, has saved, you know, a couple million lives in China. So that's also part of the dynamic.
Peter, you covered the 2008 Games in Beijing. How do you expect China's self-presentation to differ in 2008 and now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a totally different moment. 2008, they were looking out. I mean, you know, they won that bid in 2001. I was there for that as well. And at that point, I mean, China wanted to prove to the world that it was no longer a poor country, that it had arrived. And so 2008 was this moment where they were telling the world, you know, we are now, you know, a world power, but also a prosperous country with active and engaged citizens. And I think this year is completely different. In that year, there was a sense that China needed the Olympics. You know, we need this to show the world something. I think that this year, really, the International Olympic Committee needed China, because when the bids for the Olympic Games were made in 2013 and the decision was made in 2015, everybody pulled out. All the European countries pulled out, and you know, Oslo was the favorite. They decided that they didn't have the support to do it, and it ended up just being Kazakhstan, the city of Almaty, and China. And so the IOC decided on China basically because they knew they could pull it off. Focus now is going to be much more domestic. They're going to be playing this to their own citizens, I think, rather than the outside world.
Louisa, over time, Olympic Games leave behind a kind of political historical resonance, whether it was in Berlin in the 30s, Mexico City in the late 60s, certainly the games in Beijing, in Moscow in the 80s. What do you think would be a success for Beijing this time around, and what would be the opposite? What would be a failure in their eyes?
I think, Peter's referred to these games in some ways as a major domestic event. We're used to the Olympics as being as kind of huge international, but, you know, from an American's perspective, largely American event in some ways in which the world comes together. But obviously, Americans are glued to American athletes and American success, and the NBC broadcast often revolves around that. I think China will be happy to tell the story of how they pulled it off when no one else could, as Peter indicated. And I think that outside of China, it's going to be a smaller games than we're used to in some ways. The Winter Olympics is usually smaller than the Summer Olympics. We're coming right on the heels of the Tokyo Olympics, which were already the least watched games in history. Ratings were down 42% on NBC over Rio 4 years before. So, and there aren't a lot of huge names. You know, 2008 had Michael Phelps, had Usain Bolt. Now we have Mikhaila Shiffrin, but, the major figure skaters are these young Russians that not a lot of Americans have heard of. And there aren't the same kind of, names and bright lights that NBC is promoting in quite the same way. So I think in some ways, this is a games that is perhaps more than any others, like sort of flying under the radar for American audiences. And it will be a success, I think, if people know about it in some ways, because I even have a lot of friends who actually have no idea that there's about to be an Olympics, which is extraordinary.
Peter, what are the COVID restrictions? What are the COVID precautions like in Beijing as you understand them?
If you go to China now, which is hard to do, you have a long quarantine, usually 3 weeks or more. So they're not doing that for the commentators, for the athletes. But as part of that, they will have no contact with Beijing citizens. So, everybody going to the Olympics, all the people covering and the athletes are in a bubble. I mean, 2008... I mean, my favorite moment of those games was when I was at a wrestling match and was just walking through the stands. I actually didn't go as a journalist. I just bought tickets and went to the events. And I was walking through the stands and I overheard some people talking and they said, oh, you know, the father of that guy who's wrestling, he's sitting up there. And I went up there and sure enough, there was this old guy who was, straight out of the countryside, watching his kid wrestle in the Olympics. And I watched him through that entire day. You had this kind of contact. That's not going to be there this time. The commentators are not going to be on the street in Beijing talking to people. They're not going to be in the stands talking to people. It's unclear if they're even going to be fans. I mean, earlier they said they were going to have fans and they're going to be allowed to clap, but they couldn't shout. They were already saying that they're going to reduce the spectators and they may decide to have none at all like Tokyo.
It's amazing what gets leached out of a sporting event when there are no fans, whether it was the NBA playoffs last year or the Tokyo Games. Just the absence of that energy is just so striking, isn't it, Lisa?
Absolutely. And I think it's particularly true for the Olympics because, I mean, part of the Olympics isn't just to figure out who is the best, bobsledder in the world. It's to create these connections between these sudden heroes in our lives. And part of what the Olympics magic is that connection they build out of almost nothing with the crowd. You know, it's so spontaneous and it's so pure in some way. And for that to be gone, we know it's a little sad.
These athletes who have been training since they're children, year after year after year, day after day in a swimming pool, hours and hours, and then the zenith of their career, which is just going to take a minute or two or maybe 15 minutes if it's a long race, it's played out in absolute quiet. It was so strange to see that in Tokyo.
Simone Biles was obviously one of the big stories of Tokyo, and her parents had come to every single one of her meets in her career, in her life. She'd always look up at them and know they were there, and suddenly she looks up, they're not there, and obviously that happens in people's lives, but it happened for this particular reason. And that's true of every single athlete. Part of it is the pride of representing their country and the pride they feel when they see their families and their friends. And that's not there. They really have to figure out how to do it for themselves.
Recently, the Biden administration, as well as Canada, Australia, and I think the UK, all announced that they would have a so-called diplomatic boycott of the Olympics, which meant that their diplomats and government officials would not come to Beijing and sit in the stands.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics and Paralympic Games, given the PRC's ongoing genocide and crimes against humanity in Xinjiang and other human rights abuses. The athletes on Team USA have our full support. We will be behind them 100% as we cheer them on from home. We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the games.
Have they indicated the administration?
Do the Chinese care at all, Peter?
Yeah, no, this kind of thing bothers them, and they will retaliate. In Los Angeles 2028, something will happen. I guarantee you, right? There'll be, and look at the countries that didn't participate in this. France, right? France is 2024. They said that, you know, we're going. There's a reason for that. The Chinese will retaliate. You know, when the Nobel Prize was given, you know, Norway got hit. When Australia called for an investigation into the origins of, you know, the coronavirus, Australian beef gets hit, right? So there will be retaliation for this, definitely. The Chinese care. I mean, the real question, I think, is what happens if athletes make statements, which I think is bound to happen. When an athlete, you know, says something about the internment camps in Xinjiang and the oppression of Muslim people in China, what is the Chinese response going to be? Because the IOC has really just left them out there. I mean, the IOC has said nothing about the political events. They've, you know, basically just washed their hands of it. And really, so it's up to the athletes. And there's not going to be any local dissidents. And so how does the Chinese government respond to that? That's really a big question. And a lot of people that I've talked to are very concerned about this.
Now, given what you're saying, Peter, it seems the responsibility on NBC, the network carrying the Olympics, it's even more intense than ever. Louisa, how does NBC go about playing this? On the one hand, they have a news division. And on the other hand, NBC, as it were, is in business with China. And so is the IOC. So how do they handle this? And how have they handled it in the past?
It's not as it were. They are in business with the IOC. They are actually partners with the IOC. And I imagine that there will be some pretty strong, you know, division between the news division and the broadcast. I mean, you might hear some reference during the opening ceremonies to the diplomatic boycott, but I doubt it. The question will be if athletes are asked at any point about internments or, you know, any of the other questions that could be asked. And if they answer in a certain way, you know, how will NBC report that? If at all, will we see it? Will we know it? That remains to be seen. And the IOC was asked about this, actually. They were saying, what if an athlete protests? And they said, well, that's a hypothetical. I mean, that was the word they used.
I find it strange that the United States in the 80s refused to come to Moscow, and the pretext and the reason for that policy was Afghanistan. At this moment, the Chinese government is doing what it's doing with the Uyghurs, which is an abomination. And yet our protest is much milder. What is the rationale for that?
I mean, I think that there is... The Biden administration has said that they don't want to take away the athletes' chance to, you know, you mentioned before, these athletes have trained their whole lives. I think a lot of the athletes who missed out in 1980 were devastated. They've been looking forward to this, and there is a sense that you don't want to punish them for something that China is doing and for some fight that China and the United States are having. Or the UK or any other country. And so they've taken this kind of much milder route. I think that there is less of a focus, a coherent focus on international affairs than there once was. I think that's safe to say. The Cold War was something that Americans broadly understood as being fully invested in. Now, you know, we're a much more fractured society in a lot of ways. And I think that there is... not the same sort of sense of social cohesion, although, you know, obviously we were fractured in all sorts of other ways back then too. So I don't want to make too strong a statement, and I'm speculating a little bit here, but I do think that to a lot of people, what's happening in China feels far away, whereas what was happening with the Soviet Union maybe felt more pressing to your kind of regular Americans.
Well, I think it's also, just the politics change and the tools change. I think the boycott has become less palatable. You know, this is also, remember the Chinese, they competed in 1952. They didn't compete again until 1984 because the IOC was recognizing athletes from Taiwan. You know, the Chinese had, you know, that long period, 30 years, where they were not part of the Olympic movement. And, you know, the Taiwanese athletes still go. They don't compete under the Taiwanese flag, but it's, you know, the Chinese decided that they wanted to compete. And I think that the idea of a full boycott, an athletic boycott, is not nearly as likely now. And I think that after 1980, there was a general sense that the athletes had paid a high price for missing those games. And so I think people, you know, want to find other tools if they want to speak out about what's going on in Xinjiang.
On the hopes of ending on a high note and maybe a less political note, what athletic performance are you looking forward to in these games? Louisa.
Well, I'm one of those people who actually like watching people, you know, move around on little sticks. So I am really looking forward to the cross country. I think Jesse Diggins is going to be on my TV a lot.
You are killing me. You know the names of cross country skiers.
She's amazing.
Okay, I'm with you. I'll be watching.
You know, I spent just countless hours of my childhood not only watching the Olympics, but recording them on VHS, which kids these days will not have heard of, and then rewatching the Olympics.
Wow.
So I go, I actually did watch a lot of luge and bobsled.
Peter, what athletic performance are you looking forward to?
I like the skiing, and my daughters enjoy it, because we live in Colorado and they ski. So we're watching skiing and snowboarding. They were very excited by Chloe Kim last time, and I suspect we'll be watching her again.
Peter Hessler, Louisa Thomas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Hessler has lived in and reported from China for many years, and Louisa Thomas covers sports for us. You can find all their work at NewYorker.com. On our podcast, Politics and More, this week, Dorothy Wickenden talks with staff writer Rebecca Mead, who's based in the UK, and she's been covering Partygate, the COVID scandal over a series of holiday parties at 10 Downing Street that's become a full-blown crisis for Boris Johnson's government. Recently, Rebecca wrote in The New Yorker, the alleged partying was not merely a festive season lapse on the part of staffers, of whose shenanigans the prime minister, sequestered in his upper story flat, was unaware. There were shenanigans all the way down. Rebecca joins us on the Politics and More podcast this week. And there's much more to come on The New Yorker Radio Hour today, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When we hear from a whistleblower, it often sets off frenetic news cycles. Think of the recent Facebook revelations, first in the Wall Street Journal, and then absolutely everywhere. Whistleblowers are insiders, and without them, many abuses would never come to light. Often enough, they're celebrated for a while for their bravery, and then the story recedes. But for those people who are brave enough to blow the whistle, the repercussions don't end with the news cycle. Sarah Stillman covers immigration for The New Yorker, and she has this story.
If you were paying attention to the news back in September of 2020, you probably heard about the really chilling allegations of medical mistreatment at the Erwin County Detention Center, which is a for-profit detention facility in Georgia.
Breaking news today. It's about an alarming new whistleblower complaint that alleges, quote, high numbers of female detainees, detained immigrants at an ICE detention center in Georgia, received questionable hysterectomies while in ICE custody.
Women were describing having experienced forced hysterectomies, heinous medical neglect in the midst of the pandemic.
A failing to protect both prisoners and employees from the virus.
And one of the central faces you may have seen is the face of a woman named Dawn Wooten, who was a nurse at the facility where all of this was happening. And she, along with a bunch of the women who had these experiences in detention, she spoke up about the really chilling things that she was seeing and experiencing. Recently, I got a call after all this time had passed from Dawn Wooten's attorney, and she said, you know, so many people followed that story in the news. It sparked congressional investigations. It sparked a civil lawsuit and criminal investigation about all the misconduct that Dawn had helped to reveal. But what very few people know is what happened to Dawn after she blew the whistle on this place. Dawn is a mother of five kids, and she lives in a small town about 3 hours from Atlanta in Tifton, Georgia.
Their decorations. This year was kind of rough. This whistleblowing is rough.
Yeah.
So we decorated. I really was not Christmas spirited. But the kids were already and put things out. And I told them, I said, if they give me to get something in working motion, then we can have a Christmas in July maybe. Uh-huh. So
what kept them from doing the Christmas? Just
finances.
Yeah.
Finances. Okay. We're not finances.
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of information about what whistleblowers go through after they come forward, and particularly for those who are low-wage workers. I think oftentimes the whistleblowers that we see who have made such a difference in our society, people like recently the Facebook employees who came forward or people who've come forward to reveal things happening at the upper echelons of the U.S. government, we don't think as much about what is the cost of coming forward for those who live at a more precarious end of the economic spectrum. What are the emotional but also even the basic financial effects on their ability to get by?
To be actually asked, where am I, how am I faring, means the world at this moment to us. And I'm going to include the babies, too, because we've been on a topsy-turvy downward spiral around the mountain world.
Yeah.
It's kind of like fruit basket turnover. So I'm grateful. For the opportunity.
I'm curious, like, if you were talking to someone who you didn't know at that time and who was asking you, like, what is your job? Like, how would you have described your job to someone who knew nothing about the immigration detention context at that time?
Describing the actual place that I worked at was not fit for my pet chihuahua that I don't own. And I'm being facetious when I say this and very sarcastic. Mm. It was more of a place of a kennel, or I would say an animal shelter. It was not clean, to the point they did not have adequate, at times, adequate water. It was not adequate for them. The food, I have seen maggots in the food.
Oh, my God. As appalling as that is to hear, Dawn started to learn things that she found even more disturbing.
So I have this young lady that I can see her, Sarah, to this day. I can call her name. We had a conversation because we always had conversations talking about her family and her kids and her children and when she gets out of here. She comes to me and she said, "Miss Wooten, can you see what procedure I've had?" I brought back, "Hey, you've had a hysterectomy." And other ladies, "Hey, you've had your tubes removed. Hey, you've had your ovaries. Hey, you've had a DNC. Your uterus has been thinned. Hey, you've had this surgical procedure." And in the midst of talking to these ladies, from one person to 12, 12 to 24 requests at this time, I walk over to the pharmacy. And I'm sitting at my cart and I'm going, "What in the world is going on here? What in the hell did I walk into?" And after I go through all of those emotions, Sarah, it's like I'm coming home one day in my truck and my eyes are full of water. And I'm like, "Okay, God, what do you want me to do? You've got a sense of humor. This is not funny. What do you want me to do?" And I'm 20 minutes home. I pull in my driveway and I sit and I was like, "Now I understand the assignment. You want me to speak for those?" Because my grandma told me that this mouth was going to write a check one day so big my butt couldn't cash. So we always joked about it. But it's like, so now I see what it is. So now I get to work. I come back and I'm asking questions like my supervisor, superior, "Oh, you want to leave that alone? Oh, you don't want to touch that? Oh, you don't want to bother that? Oh, you don't want to talk about that?" So now I'm getting that type of treatment now coming through. And I'm like, it's got to be something that's going on here. So now I've turned in from LPN to inch eye, private eye, because I just can't let this go.
Do you remember what was the moment when you realized you were being retaliated against at work?
The moment I realized I was being retaliated on, when I was written up, and I hadn't been written up out of the 12 years I've been nursing, or I hadn't been written up out of the 3 cycles I had been through that place. Mm-hmm. I automatically knew that they were building a case with this write-up because I didn't have a write-up on my file. So when she wrote me up bogusly for no call, no show, I've never been a no call, no show. When I had the conversation with the deputy warden, he said, "Don't just take it. It's just a write-up. That's all you have to do." I said, "But it's a lie. It's not the truth. I have a doctor's excuse for the day she's proclaiming that I was a no call, no show." I went outside of my car, came back with the doctor's excuse for the time. "Well, you might want to take this to the warden." I asked him, I said, "What is going on? I've never been written up. I've never had a problem in this place. You've never had any issues with me." He said, "He'll call me when he need me."
Suddenly, Dawn just stops getting work. They demoted her from full-time status to an as-needed employee, and then essentially, they just never call. Dawn's really struggling with that. She's floundering about what to do. And then at that point, she hears about this grassroots advocacy organization called Project South. And they have been looking into these conditions at the detention center for years. They've been talking to many, many women who've been directly affected by it and organizing around it. And then together with a bunch of other groups, they all decide to file a complaint with the Department of Homeland Security at the Office of the Inspector General. And Dawn also files a separate whistleblower complaint. And those land in September of 2020. The Intercept picks it up, a small legal blog does too in an even more sensational way, and suddenly the story just goes viral on social media. You know, suddenly Dawn is making appearances on the national news networks, on Rachel Maddow. She's on Chris Hayes.
Ms. Wooten, I want to start with you and just ask you to tell us what you did. What was your job at this facility? When did you start working there?
I was first employed at Irwin County Detention Center in 2010. I've been to this facility.
It just exploded. September 14th, I never forget 2020. You can find me now on Google. You never could type my name in, but you can type my name in. So this thing became live. And I'm still brain fogged at this time. Like, what is a whistleblower? What did I just do? Or, you know, never thought that I would wake up every day for a certain period of time and have to hear it and 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 hear it. I never thought that it would be to this degree. I was everywhere. My emotions were everywhere. I was depressed. I should have been excited. I done a good thing. Angry and I'm fearful at the same time. So if doing a good thing costs me my job and doing a thing costs me now my life, now I also have people on the reverse end that want my throat. Now I'm messing with the commodity in a small heck town city that they make their money is the biggest industrial part of them flourishing in the city. Now I'm messing with that economically. So now I don't know who wants my head on a platter.
That's Dawn Wooten, the whistleblower in the revelations about the Irwin County Detention Center in 2020. Our story continues in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're listening to a story about an extraordinarily brave woman named Dawn Wooten. Wooten is a nurse in her 40s, and she's got five kids. In 2020, she was working at the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. It's an ICE facility run by a for-profit company. Wooten learned about medical maltreatment of female detainees at the center. Some truly heinous abuses were being committed. And working with an organization called Project South, Wooten helped file a complaint with the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. But after that revelation became big news, Dawn Wooten's own ordeal just began. We'll pick up her story there.
My baby was at school and somebody called me and said, we're going to kidnap your children. My son told me there was a car that hung outside of the school that they were attending every day for about a week. So I don't know if somebody wants them or not, or if somebody's after my kids to hurt me because they feel like I've hurt them because I've spoke up for something that was right.
You can imagine that this kind of blowback would be so hard to navigate. And, you know, frankly, Dawn was lucky in this case to have an attorney. She also had the support of grassroots groups she was working with, like Project South, which arranged for security for her.
We were whisked away under security for a couple of months, living hotel to hotel. Every so often, we had to leave a hotel in Atlanta to go stay at another hotel. It was very, very depressing. And with kids in the beginning, it's an adventure. But by the time you get to the third hotel, they're tired of being in a hotel 24, just about 7. We only came out to eat and we're back in. I mean, and then going to strange places to wash clothes. And it was just not home. It was it was very, very depressing. I wound up on antidepressants and my child on antidepressants and anxiety. And it was mortifying.
I mean, do you remember any of what they would ask you during that time or what they would say during that time?
My daughter is, she'll be 20 next month. She 19, 18 at the time. So she's got her first boyfriend at the time. They're having to talk by phone, not being home. She was like, I hate it. I really hate it. She was like, Mom, I'm glad you spoke up, but I hate this. I hate it. So I had to sit down and talk with her and say, hey, sometimes I feel like you. Sometimes I'm like, I should have kept my mouth closed. Then I have to shake myself and say, wait a minute. What if it was you? So I brought it to her that way. What if it was you wanting to bear children or you wanting to be heard or you wanting to know what was going on and nobody had any answers for you? That's kind of scary, isn't it? And she was like, yes, ma'am. So I brought them in that way and what we were really standing for in that moment.
And let's talk about the effects that's had on you financially. I mean, it sounds like you've gone through this stretch having a really difficult time finding work elsewhere.
It has. When it started, there was a GoFundMe out there at first. Whenever that first GoFundMe did, it helped me catch my rent up. So I was caught up with the rent here. A few bills. I was able to catch my vehicle up because they were getting ready to drag it or repossess it. And then was not thinking that I was not going to be employed. So paid things up, paid things off, got things, bought things because I didn't want any overhead. Things that the kids needed. So that money just kind of went like the wind blowing a grain of sand.
So at this point, you might be thinking, don't we have whistleblower protections in place that would help someone in Don's position? And maybe you've even seen in the news stories about whistleblowers who have made millions of dollars coming forward about, you know, corporate wrongdoing. But the truth is, there is no single law that protects whistleblowers, and it's actually a very complex patchwork of laws and protections. And those protections really depend on, you know, what kind of employee you are, the kind of information that you're disclosing. And so in Dawn's case, you know, her main option was to file a whistleblower complaint with an incredibly backlogged system at the Department of Homeland Security at the Office of the Inspector General. And after that, there was very little she could do but just, you know, wait and wait some more for the government to act. And during this time, she's trying to find steady work. She's, you know, applying to job after job. And in fact, her lawyers actually sent me a spreadsheet that showed more than 100 jobs to which she'd applied. And that included, you know, COVID vaccination jobs, jobs doing COVID tests with the nasal swabs, jobs in palliative care, nephrology.
I was actually employed with the local hospital here at their nursing home facility 20 minutes from here. One of the nurses called me and said, Dawn, they just took you off payroll.
Oh, my God.
My supervisor there at the time didn't even have the decency to call me and say, hey, Dawn, they took you off. You're a liability, whatever, whatever. So I'm thinking, okay, so, and here I am going to McDonald's. I went to the McDonald's here, and Tiffany was going to flip some burgers as a nurse. Mm-hmm. And the girl recognized, you're so-and-so's mama. So she calls my daughter's name. She's like, yeah, TV. So the manager comes out and was like, well, I better call the main office. So I never heard anything back from the McDonald's. I was like, well, darn, I can't even flip burgers.
Yeah. It's wild to think at a moment when our country so desperately needs nurses in the midst of this pandemic, it sounds like most of the time you just don't hear back at all.
Or if I hear back from somebody, they're calling me saying, hey, we can interview you. They do their research and somebody calls back and said, oh, like I had the nursing home here in Tifton. I had them to call me and say that me and my daughter were hired. So I'm like, yay, this was up in last year. We're going to go to work. She calls me back on a Saturday and say, I'm sorry, Miss Wooten. They did some hiring over the weekend. If anything comes open, I'll call you. So I waited a week and I called back and I pretended to be somebody else. And I said, hi, my name is Melissa. I'm calling from Tifton, Georgia, and I'm an LPN. I've been nursing for about 12 years. Do you have any open positions? Yes. We need nurses like today. Who can't put two and two together to realize that it's connected to the Irwin County Detention Center? So I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm falling further and further behind financially. And family is like, well, we kind of needy ourselves. So it's not that you can go to family and say, hey, I need my lights, or $1,100 for rent is not a lot to come by. Now I'm back in the same boat with my truck, $400 a month, back at $1,300. And I had to tell the lady, I was like, look, I'll park it side the road. You can come and pull it. Not even going to fight with it. Once I get back up on my feet, I just get me something else. To the point to where, hey, I've got a vehicle. Now the motor's blowed up in it. That's where I am now. The motor's gone in it.
Yeah. And it sounds like right now you currently do have this nursing home job, but that you've basically been having to walk, you know, maybe even more than a mile to work. Is that right?
It's probably about a mile. Probably about a mile and maybe an inkling, a little over, not much, but I know it's a mile there and a mile back.
I wonder, this might be a hard question, but I wonder, like, if you could take us to kind of the lowest moment since all this happened for you.
I was in a motel room dealing with security, and I think we had been arguing. Because at one point, security became very unprofessional. They were cursing each other out, and one didn't want to take us here. And I have these kids, and we're hungry. We don't care if y'all have to figure it out, drive each other. We're hungry. So at this point, it's like, forget it. So we go back in the room, and we sit. And it's like, if I had just kept my mouth closed, we wouldn't be in this situation. So this is my conversation out loud. And my kids are sitting, and I'm apologizing, saying I should have never brought y'all. I took y'all through this. I never thought that y'all would be going through this. Hey, I never thought it was going to be this way. It got to a point to where it was like, if I disappear, then y'all will be good. Y'all will be good because nobody will talk about me. Nobody will discuss me. I'll be a figment of their imagination. I'll be a memory. I mean, and then I sit about 20 minutes and I have to pull myself back in, and I'm looking at my children going, I can't die now. I mean, not now. I can't. Don't. You can't die now. Don't. You can't get depressed now. Don't. You can't clam up now. But I shake myself and I'm like, wait a minute. hey, so you lay down, you wake up the next day and it's like, OK, so who wants to hear my story today?
And what do you wish people knew about your experience looking over everything that you have been through in this past year? Like, what do you feel like people don't know about the long-term aftermath of what you've faced?
It's okay to blow the whistle. It is okay. And this is going to sound probably weird, but you need a prepared readiness course. Life itself did not prepare me for you possibly won't be employed. If you speak out, you won't be employed. And I'm kind of sort of glad you don't get that in the beginning, because I probably would not have. But it's feasible. It's workable. In the long run, you're saving somebody's life. In the long run, you're saving somebody's productivity and mental welfare and well-being, even if it means that you at some point pay a price for yours.
In May of last year, the government made a really big announcement, which is that they were terminating their ICE contract with ICDC after the revelations that had been brought public by Dawn and by the detained women and by the activists who've been fighting for this for so many years. So as you can imagine, that was a really big victory for all of them. But it was also very far from the end of the story, because Dawn and the women are still waiting for justice. Many of the women have filed a civil lawsuit, and that is still winding its way through the courts. And for Dawn, in her case, her whistleblower retaliation complaint has still not been resolved. The government legally had 180 days to respond, and they blew past that deadline. They asked for more time, and then they blew past another. So Don's lawyer, Dana Gold, at the Government Accountability Project, told me that her team is fighting to change federal policy so that people like Don, with a credible claim, could get some kind of temporary relief while they wait for the deeper investigation, which, you know, can be a really long and costly process. So Gold stressed that the current protections that are in place for whistleblowers, especially low-wage ones, really just are not enough. So the question that sticks with me is, you know, what would it look like if we actually created an environment in which a whistleblower who wants to step forward and do the right thing can feel protected to share information that really, in the end, protects all of us?
It's like everybody's getting answers but me. And everybody's getting relief but these women. So we're the only two left hanging in the balance. Mm-hmm. These women still have scars that they have to carry from here until the end of their time on this earth. And my voice with their bodies paved the way for the decision to be made. So what's holding up? Each day is lost time for me. It's lost time.
Dawn Wooten is a nurse in Georgia. The company that operated the Irwin County Detention Center, LaSalle Corrections, did not respond to our request for comment about Wooten's retaliation complaint. About the allegations of mistreatment of detainees, they previously issued a statement saying this: LaSalle Corrections is firmly committed to the health and welfare of those in our care. We are deeply committed to delivering high-quality, culturally responsive services in safe and humane environments. Sarah Stillman is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and recently she reported for us about the migrant workers who go around the country repairing towns after hurricanes and other climate disasters. It's a really fascinating piece, and you can find it on the podcast of The New Yorker Radio Hour, anywhere that you go to find podcasts. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening to the show this week. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Harrison Keithline, and Meng-Fei Chen, and guidance from Emily Botine.
We had special assistance this week from Philip Greitzer on location in Georgia.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.